3 months ago. It was 3 a.m., and Owen was sitting at the hotel bar, drinking a tall glass of bourbon, straight. He felt my eyes on him and looked up. "What are you doing down here?" he said. I smiled at him. "I believe that's my question for you," I said. We were staying in San Francisco, in a boutique hotel across from the ferry building. There had been a terrible storm. It was the type of rainstorm that didn't happen in Sausalito too often, and it had forced us to evacuate our home, our floating home, due to flooding risks. It forced us to take refuge on the other side of the Bay Bridge, the hotel filled up with other floating home expats, though apparently Owen wasn't finding much refuge at all. He shrugged. "Thought I'd come downstairs to have a drink," he said. "Do some work."
"On what?" I said.
I looked around. He didn't have his laptop with him. No papers lying around. There was nothing on the bar at all, except his bourbon. And one other thing. "Want to have a seat?" he said. I sat down on the bar stool next to him, wrapping my arms more tightly around myself. I was chilly in the middle of the night coolness. My tank top and sweatpants weren't much of a match.
"You're freezing," he said.
"I'm okay." He pulled off his hoodie, putting it over my head.
"You will be," he said.
I looked at him and waited. I waited for him to tell me what he was really doing down here, what was worrying him enough that he left our room, that he left me in the bed, his daughter on the pull-out couch.
"Work is just a little stressful, that's all. But nothing's wrong. Nothing I can't handle."
He nodded, like he meant it. But he seemed stressed. He seemed more stressed than I'd seen him before. When we were packing our bags to come here, I found him in Bailey's room, packing up Bailey's childhood piggy bank, putting it in his duffel bag. He'd looked embarrassed when I saw him, and explained that it was one of the first presents he'd gotten her. He didn't want to risk anything happening to it. That wasn't the weird part. Owen was packing up all sorts of sentimental things, Bailey's first hairbrush, family photo albums, and dropping them in his overnight bag. The weird part was that the other thing on the bar, besides his drink, was Bailey's piggy bank. "So, if you've got it handled, why are you sitting here by yourself in the middle of the night staring at your daughter's piggy bank?"
"Thinking of breaking it open," he said, "in case we need the money."
"What's going on, Owen?" I said.
"Do you know what Bailey said to me tonight when I told her we had to evacuate? She said she wanted to go with Bobby's family instead, that they're staying at the Ritz, and she wanted to be with him. It turned into a whole big thing."
"Where was I?"
"Locking down your workshop."
I shrugged, trying to be gentle. "She's growing up."
"I know. It's totally normal. I get it. But the strangest thing happened when I told her no," he said. "I watched her stomp after me toward the car, and I just kept thinking, she's going to leave me. Maybe it's being a single parent all this time, just trying to keep the two of us above water. But I don't think I ever fully thought about the fact. Or maybe I just didn't let myself."
"So that's why you are downstairs looking at her piggy bank in the middle of the night?"
"Maybe. Or maybe it's just a strange bed," he said. "Can't sleep."
He picked up his bourbon, held it near his lips.
"When she was a little girl, when we first got to Sausalito, she was scared to walk down the docks. I think it was because the day after we moved in, Mrs. Hahn slipped and fell, and Bailey saw her almost go down, almost land in the water."
"That's terrible," I say.
"Yeah, well, for those first couple of months, she would make me hold her hand the whole way down the docks, from our front door all the way to the parking lot. And she'd ask as we went, 'Daddy, you're going to keep me safe, right? Daddy, you're not going to let me fall.' It took us like 6.5 hours to get from the front door to the car."
I laughed.
"It drove me crazy. The 100th time I had to do it, I actually think I went a little crazy.
He paused.
And you know the only thing worse than that? The day she stopped.
I put my hand on his elbow, held him there, my heart exploding a little at his love for her.
There is going to come a time when I won't be able to keep her safe anymore. Not from anything, he said. I won't even be able to tell her no anymore.
Well, I can relate to that, I said. I can't even tell her no now. He looked over at me, bourbon still in hand, and laughed. He really laughed. My joke breaking his sadness, splintering it for him. He put down his drink and turned toward me.
On a scale of 1 to 10, how weird is it that I'm sitting here?
Without the piggy bank? I said. It would be a 2, maybe a 3.
With the piggy bank? Am I breaking 6?
Afraid so. He put the piggy bank on an empty stool and motioned for the bartender.
Would you please make my wonderful wife here the drink of her choice?
He said.
And I'll take a cup of coffee.
Then he leaned in, put his forehead against mine.
Sorry, he said.
Don't be. It's hard. I get it. But it's not happening tomorrow. She's not leaving tomorrow, I said. And she loves you so much. She's never going to leave you completely.
I don't know about that.
I do. He kept his forehead there, touching mine.
I just hope Bailey doesn't wake up and find us gone, he said. If you look outside, you can see the Ritz.
Little White Churches. Eleanor H. McGovern peers at Bailey over her bifocals.
So let me get this straight, she says. You want to know what?
We are sitting in Eleanor's office at an Episcopal church. It's a large church, one of the oldest cathedrals in Austin, more than 100 years old, and just over a half mile from the football stadium. But most important, it is the only church we've walked into, the final of 6 contenders that Bailey said felt familiar to her.
We are just looking for a list of weddings that were held here during the 2008 football season, Bailey says. Eleanor, who is in her early 70s and pushing 6 feet tall, looks at us, overwhelmed.
It's less complicated than it sounds, I say. We actually just need a list of the weddings your pastor performed during the home games of the 2008 season. And we don't need the weddings that fell on the other days of those weekends, just the weddings that happened to actually take place during the Longhorns' home games. That's all.
Oh, during the home games from 12 years ago? Is that all?
I ignore her tone and plow forward, hoping to turn her around. I actually already did the legwork, I say. I nudge the list across the table toward her. I've created a chart with the Longhorn schedule from 12 years ago. I had Jules cross-check it at the San Francisco Chronicle, using their research tools, just to be sure that we didn't miss any of the games, just to make sure we checked all the boxes. There are only 8 dates in question. There are only 8 dates when a small Bailey could have been walking into the stadium with Owen, could have found herself sitting here. Eleanor stares at the list, but she doesn't make a move to pick it up. I look around the office for clues about her, clues that may help me win her over. Christmas cards and bumper stickers cover her desk. Photographs of Eleanor's family are lined up on the fireplace mantel. A large bulletin board is brimming over with photographs and notes from parishioners. The office reveals 40 years of building relationships right in this room, in this church. She knows everything about this place. We just need to know one small piece of it.
I know it seems like a lot, I say, but if you take a look, you'll see we have downloaded the home game schedule from the 2008 season, and we are looking at fewer than 10 weekends. We have them all for you, ready to go. Even if your pastor officiated 2 weddings a weekend, it'd be fewer than 20 couples.
Look, Eleanor says, I'm sorry,
I'm simply not authorized to give out that information. I understand that's the policy, and why that's the policy, I say. But you must agree, these are exceptional circumstances. Of course, it's terrible to hear that your husband is missing. It seems you are dealing with a lot because of his absence, but that doesn't change our policy. Can't you make an exception to your policy? Bailey says, her tone too harsh. We clearly aren't serial killers or anything. We could care less who these people are. I put my hand on Bailey's leg, trying to calm her. We can sit here while we read the names, I say. No printouts or addresses even have to leave this room. Eleanor looks back and forth between us, like she is torn between helping us and kicking us out. But it looks like she's leaning toward kicking us out. I can't let that happen. Not when it's possible we are onto something. If we can figure out what wedding Owen and Bailey attended, we'll understand their tie to Austin. And maybe that tie will help explain what Grady was doing on my doorstep, what Owen is doing so far away from it. I really think Bailey may have been at this church, I say. It would be very helpful to her, to both of us, to know for sure. And if you knew what we've been through this week without her father, let's just say it would be an act of kindness. I see the sympathy percolate in Eleanor's eyes and feel hopeful suddenly that my plea has put her on the side of helping. I'd like to help you. I would, but it's not something I can do, dear. If you want to leave your number, I can check with the pastor, but I just don't think that he's going to want to provide our parishioners' personal details. Jesus, lady, you're not going to give us a break here? Bailey says. It's admittedly not great language for her to use. Eleanor stands up, her head dangerously close to hitting the ceiling. I'm going to need to excuse myself now, friends, she says. We have a Bible study group this evening that I need to prepare for in the conference room, so if you wouldn't mind showing yourselves out. Look, Bailey didn't mean to be rude to you, but her father is missing, and we're just trying to find out why. It's putting our family under a great deal of stress. Family is everything to us, as I'm sure you can understand. I motion toward the photographs lining the mantel above the fireplace. The Christmas shots of her children and grandchildren, the candid shots of her husband, their dogs, a farm, several photographs of Eleanor and perhaps her favorite grandchild, sporting some crazy streaked hair of his own. His is a shade of green. I'm sure you'd be the first to go to great lengths for your family, I say. I can see that about you. Please just think about it for a second. If I were sitting there, and you were sitting here, I'm just asking you, what would you hope I'd do? Because I'd try to do it. She pauses and straightens her dress. Then, miraculously, Eleanor sits back down, pushing her bifocals higher on her nose. Let me see what I can do, she says. Bailey smiles in relief. The names can't leave this room. They won't leave your desk, I say. We will figure out if there is someone who can help our family. That's all. Eleanor nods and pulls my list across the desk. Then she picks it up. She looks down at it in her hands as though she can't believe she is doing this. She sighs, so we know she can't believe she's doing this. She turns to her computer, starting to type. Thank you, Bailey says. Thank you so much. Thank your stepmother, Eleanor says. Which is when an amazing thing happens. Bailey doesn't cringe when I'm referred to that way. She doesn't thank me. She doesn't even look at me. But she doesn't cringe, which feels a little like the same thing. I don't have any time to savor it, though, because my phone starts to buzz. I look down to see a text from Carl. I'm outside your house. Can you let me in? I've been knocking. I look to Bailey, touch her hand. That's Carl, I say. I'm going to see what he wants. Bailey nods, barely acknowledging me, her eyes focused on Eleanor. I head out into the hallway and text him that I'm calling him now.
Hey, he says when he picks up. Can I come in? I've got Sarah with me. We were on a walk.
I picture him standing outside our front door, Sarah and her baby Bjorn, wearing one of the enormous bows Patty loves to stick on top of her head. Carl using his walk with his daughter as an excuse with Patty. An excuse to come and talk to me without Patty knowing.
We aren't home, Carl, I say. What's going on?
It's really not a phone type of conversation, he says. I'd rather talk in person. I can come back later if that's better. I walk Sarah at 5:15, get her some fresh air before dinner.
I'd rather hear what you have to say now, I say.
He pauses, not sure what to do.
I can see him considering whether to insist we do this in person later, when it will be easier for him to spin whatever he needs to spin. Because I've had no doubt, since I saw the look on his face yesterday, that there is something he knows, something he is afraid to say.
Look, I just feel real bad about what happened when you came to the house yesterday, he says. I was caught off guard. And Patty was already so pissed, but I owe you an apology. It wasn't right, especially when...
He pauses, like he is still trying to figure out whether to say it.
Well, maybe I should back up. I mean, I don't know exactly what Owen told you, but he was really struggling at work. He was really struggling with Avid.
He told you that? I say.
Yeah. He didn't go into a whole lot of detail, but he said he was under a lot of pressure to get the software working, he says. He told me that much. He told me it wasn't going as smoothly as Avid had let on, but that his back was against the wall.
That stops me. What do you mean, his back was against the wall?
He said he couldn't just walk away, go get another job. That he had to fix what was happening.
Did he say why? I say.
That part he didn't get into, I swear to you. And I tried to push him on it. No job is worth that kind of stress.
I look back into Eleanor's office, Eleanor still staring at her computer, Bailey pacing back and forth.
Thanks for letting me know.
Wait, there's something else.
I can hear him struggle. I can hear him struggle with how to even put the words together.
There's something else I need to tell you.
Just say it, Carl.
We didn't invest in the shop, Patty and me, he says.
I think back to what Patty said to me, how she called Owen a crook, how she accused him of stealing their money. I don't understand.
I needed to use that money for something else, something I couldn't tell Patty about. Something to do with Kara, he says.
Kara. The co-worker Carl's been involved with on and off since before Sarah was born. What exactly? I say.
I'd rather not go into the details, but I thought you should know that, he says.
I can imagine a variety of scenarios that would cost him tens of thousands of dollars. The one percolating to the surface involves another baby, and another baby Bjorn, who also belongs to him, to both of them. But I'm guessing, and I don't have time to guess. I also don't particularly care. What I care about is that Owen didn't do what Patty accused him of doing. It almost feels like a kind of proof, a piece lining up to help me prove it to myself. Owen is still Owen. So, even with what's going on, you're letting your wife think that Owen took the money from you? That he convinced you to invest your savings in a fraudulent company?
I realize it's messed up, he says.
You think?
Can I at least get some points for telling the truth? He says. This is the last conversation I want to be having.
I think of Patty. Self-righteous Patty telling her book club, her wine club, her tennis group, telling just about anyone in Ladies Central who will listen to her that Owen is a crook. Telling everyone the false information her husband has fed her. No, Carl. The last conversation you want to be having is the one you are about to have, with your wife. Because either you're going to tell her the truth or I'll do it for you. This is when I hang up, my heart racing. I don't give myself time to process the implications of what he's told me, because Bailey is motioning for me to come back in.
I pull myself together and walk back into Eleanor's office.
Sorry about that, I say.
That's quite all right, Eleanor says. I'm just pulling everything up.
Bailey starts to move around the desk toward Eleanor, but Eleanor stops her with her hand.
Let me just print the records out, she says, and you can have a look. But I do need to get to that meeting, so you're going to have to move quickly for me.
We will, I say. But then Eleanor stops typing. She looks at the screen, confused.
This is the 2008 season you're talking about? She says.
I nod. Yes, first home game was the first weekend in September.
I see that from the document, Eleanor says.
What I'm asking is, are you sure of the year?
Pretty sure, I say.
Why?
2008? Bailey is trying not to look irritated.
2008, yes.
We were closed that fall for construction, she says. It was a major renovation. There had been a fire. Doors shut on September 1st, and we didn't open again for services, no ceremonies of any kind until March. No weddings.
Eleanor moves the screen so we can see the calendar for ourselves, all the empty squares.
My heart drops.
Maybe you have your year wrong, Eleanor says to Bailey.
Let me check 2009 for you.
I reach out my hand to stop her. There is no point in checking 2009. Owen and Bailey moved to Sausalito in 2009. I have the records of that, and in 2007, Bailey would have been too young to remember much of anything. She has no memories of Seattle during that time, let alone a sole weekend trip to Austin. If we are being honest with ourselves, even 2008 is a stretch. But if her mother was at the wedding, and Bailey thinks she may have been, then 2008 is the only time it could have been.
Look, it had to be 2008, she says.
Bailey's voice starts to shake as she looks at the empty screen.
I was here, and that's the only time it could have been. We've gone over this. It was that fall. It would have had to have been then if my mother was with us.
Maybe it was 2007, Eleanor says.
I would have been too young to remember any of it then.
Then it wasn't here, Eleanor says.
But that doesn't make sense, Bailey says. I mean, I recognize the apps. I remember it.
I move toward Bailey, but she moves away. She isn't interested in being appeased. She is interested in getting to the bottom of this.
Eleanor, I say, are there other churches in walking distance of campus that look like yours? Something we may have missed that may have reminded Bailey of your church?
Eleanor shakes her head.
No, not with a cathedral that is reminiscent of ours, she says.
Maybe a church that has since closed down?
I don't think so.
But why don't you leave your phone number? I can ask the pastor, some of our parishioners, and I will call if I remember anything. You have my word on that.
What are you possibly going to remember? Bailey says. Why don't you just say you can't help us?
Bailey, stop, I say.
Stop! You're the one who said if I remember something, we need to track it down, and now you're telling me to stop? She says.
Whatever.
I'm so freaking done with this.
She stands up quickly, storming out of Eleanor's office. Eleanor and I watch her go silently. She gives me a kind look once Bailey has gone.
It's fine, she says. I know it's not me that she's angry with.
Actually, it may be, I say. But it's misplaced. She needs to be mad at her father, and he's not here to hear it, so she's turning it on everyone else.
Understood, Eleanor says. Thank you for your time, I say. If you do think of anything, even if it feels unimportant, please call. I write down my cell number.
Of course.
She nods, putting the number in her pocket as I start walking to the door.
Who does this to his family? She asks.
I turn around and meet her eyes.
Sorry? I say.
Who does this to his family? She says again.
The best father I've ever known, I want to say,
Someone without a choice, I say. That's who. That's who does this to his family.
We always have a choice, Eleanor says.
We always have a choice. That's what Grady said, too. What does that even mean? That there is a right thing to do and there is a wrong thing to do. Simple. Judgmental. And if you are the person someone is asking that question about, you have chosen wrong. As if the world is divided between the people who have never made a big mistake and the people who have. I think of Carl on the phone, telling me that Owen was struggling. I think of how he must be struggling wherever he is now. I feel my own anger rising. I'll keep that in mind, I say, my tone matching Bailey's, and I head out the door to join her. Not everyone is a good helper. When we get back to the hotel, we order grilled cheese and sweet potato fries from room service. I turn on the television. There's an old romantic comedy playing on basic cable. Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan finding their way to each other against all odds. It's familiarity, a sedative. It lulls us. Bailey falls asleep on her bed. I stay up, watching the rest of the movie, waiting for the moment I know is coming. Tom Hanks promising Meg Ryan that he has her, that he will love her, for as long as they both shall live. Then the credits roll, and it's back to the dark hotel room in this strange city, and it returns with a terrifying jolt. Owen is gone, without explanation. Gone. This is the terrible thing about a tragedy. It isn't with you every minute. You forget it, and then you remember it again, and you see it with a stark quality. This is what is required of you now, just to get along. I'm too riled up to sleep, so I start going back through my notes from the day, trying to construct another way to utilize the wedding weekend to spark Bailey's memory. What were she and Owen doing in Austin besides going to the wedding? Was it possible they were here longer than that? Maybe Bailey isn't wrong. Maybe that's the reason the campus looked familiar to her. Did she spend more time there than that one weekend? And why? I'm relieved when my phone rings, interrupting my thoughts. No good answers to my questions. I pick up the phone, Jake coming up on the caller ID. I've been trying to reach you for hours, he says. Sorry, I whisper. It's been a long day. Where are you? Austin.
Texas? He says.
I head into the hallway, gently closing the hotel room door, careful not to wake Bailey. There's a longer explanation, but essentially, Bailey had memories of being in Austin when she was young. I don't know. Maybe I pushed her to think she had memories of being here. But between that and Grady Bradford showing up at my door, I thought we should come.
So, you're chasing leads?
Apparently not well, I say. We'll be on a plane home tomorrow. I hate hearing how those words sound. And the thought of going home to an Owenless house is terrible. At least here I'm able to harbor the illusion that I can help bring Owen back to me, that Bailey and I together can do that.
Well, look, I need to talk to you, Jake says, and you're not going to like it.
You're going to need to start by telling me something I will like, Jake, I say, or I'm hanging up on you.
Your friend Grady Bradford is legitimate. Great reputation in the service. He's one of the go-to guys in the Texas Bureau. The FBI often brings him on when a suspect goes missing. And if he wants to find Owen, I'm guessing he will.
How is that good news?
I'm not sure anyone else can find him, Jake says.
What do you mean?
Owen Michaels doesn't exist, he says.
I almost laugh. That's how ridiculous those words sound. Ridiculous, and of course wrong. I'm not saying you don't know what you're talking about, Jake, but I can assure you he exists. His daughter is sleeping 15 feet from me.
Let me rephrase, he says. Your Owen Michaels doesn't exist.
besides a birth certificate and social security number that match for both Owen and his daughter, the rest of the details are inconsistent.
What are you talking about?
The investigator I was telling you about, and he knows what he is doing, says that no Owen Michaels exists that fits your husband's biography. There are several Owen Michaels who grew up in Newton, Massachusetts, and a few who attended Princeton University. But the only Owen Michaels on record who grew up in Owen's hometown and attended Princeton is 78 years old and lives with his partner, Theo Silverstein, in Provincetown, out on Cape Cod.
I'm having trouble breathing. I sit down on the hallway carpet, my back against the wall. I can feel it. A knocking in my head. A knocking in my heart. No Owen Michaels is your Owen Michaels. The words moving through me, unable to find a home.
Should I go on?
He says. No, thank you.
No Owen Michaels purchased or owned a home in Seattle, Washington in 2006, or enrolled his daughter Bailey in preschool that year, or had a registered income tax return any time before 2009.
That stops me. That was the year he and Bailey moved to Sausalito.
Exactly. That's where the record for your Owen Michaels starts. And from then on, pretty much what you told me matches up. Their home, Bailey's schooling, Owen's work. And of course, it was smart of him to purchase a floating home, as opposed to a real house, less of a paper trail. He doesn't even own the land. It's more like a rental, harder to trace.
I put my hands over my eyes, trying to stop the spinning in my head, trying to get steadier.
Before they arrived in Sausalito, I haven't found one piece of data that supports the story your husband has told you about his life. He went by another name, or he went by his current name, and just lied to you about every other thing. He lied about who he was.
I don't say anything at first. Then I manage to get out the question. Why? I say.
Why would Owen change his name? The details of his life?
He asks. I nod, as though he can see me.
I ask the investigator the same thing,
Jake says.
He says there are usually two reasons why someone changes his identity, and you're not going to like either of them.
No kidding.
The most common reason, believe it or not, is the person has a second family somewhere. Another wife, another child, or children. And he's trying to keep the two lives separate.
It's not possible, Jake, I say.
Tell that to a client we have now, this oil magnet billionaire who has a wife in North Dakota at his family's ranch, and another in San Francisco in some mansion in Pacific Heights. Down the street from Danielle Steele. 29 years he has been with both women. 5 children with one, 5 children with the other. And they have no idea. They think he travels a lot for work. They think he's a great husband. We only know about his dual families because we put a will together for him. That's going to be a fun estate reading.
What's the other reason Owen might have done this? I say.
Assuming he doesn't have another wife hanging out somewhere?
Yes, assuming that.
The other reason someone creates a false identity, which is the working theory here, is that he's involved in some sort of criminal activity,
he says.
And he ran to avoid trouble, to start a new life, to protect his family. But almost across the board, the criminal gets in trouble again, which is his undoing.
So that would mean that Owen was in trouble with the law before? That he's not only guilty of what's happening at the shop, but he's guilty of something else, too?
It would certainly explain why he ran,
Jake said.
He knew when the shop imploded, he'd be outed. He was more worried about his past catching up to him than anything else.
But by that logic, isn't it possible he isn't a criminal? I say. That he changed his name to escape someone? Someone who wanted to hurt him, or maybe even hurt Bailey? Protect her.
Sure, that's possible, he says. But why wouldn't he tell you that to begin with?
I don't have a good answer. But I need another alternative. Something else to explain why Owen isn't coming up as Owen. I don't know. Maybe he's in witness protection, I say.
That would explain Grady Bradford. I thought of that. But do you remember my buddy Alex? He has a friend who is pretty high up in the U.S. Marshal's office, so he looked into it for me. And Owen ain't being protected.
Would he tell you?
Yeah.
What kind of protection program is that?
Not a great one. Anyway, he doesn't match the profile of someone in witness protection, he says. Not his job, which is high rent, not Sausalito. Protected witnesses sell tires somewhere in Idaho, and those are the lucky ones. It's not what you see in the movies. Most witnesses just get dropped off in the middle of nowhere with a little cash in their wallets and some new IDs and are told good luck.
So then what?
For my money, it's option two. He's guilty of something, and he's been running from it for a long time. And maybe he got caught up in the shop because of that. Or maybe it's unrelated, hard to know. But it would have caught up with him if he was arrested. So he ran to save himself. Or maybe it's like you said, and he ran because he thought it was the best way to protect Bailey, to not get her caught up in whatever he's done.
It's the first thing that Jake says that penetrates. It's what I keep coming back to myself. If it were just Owen's mistakes that were going to catch up with him, he would have stayed with us. He would have faced the firing squad. But if any of this would take Bailey down with him, he would make another decision. Jake, even if you're right, even if I don't know the whole story about the man I married, I know he would only leave Bailey behind if he absolutely had to, I say. Forgetting me for a second, if he were running without any intention of coming back, he'd take her with him. She's everything to him. Owen doesn't have it in him to leave her and just disappear.
2 days ago, did you think he had it in him to make up his entire life history? Because he did do that.
I stare at the ugly hotel hallway carpet with its patterns of fuchsia roses, trying to find in them something like solace. This feels impossible. Every bit of this feels impossible. How do you begin to grapple with the idea that your husband is running from the person he used to be, a person whose real name you don't even know? You want to argue that someone is getting the story wrong. Someone is getting your story wrong. In your story, the one you know by heart, none of this makes sense. Not where this story began, not where it's going. And certainly not where it's threatening to end. Jake, how do I go back inside and tell Bailey that nothing about her father is what she thinks? I don't know how to tell her that. He gets uncharacteristically quiet.
Maybe tell her something else, he says.
Like what?
Like you have a plan to get her away from this, he says. At least until it's all sorted out.
But I don't.
But you could. You absolutely could get her away from this. Come to New York. Stay with me, both of you, at least until this is all sorted out. I have friends on the board at Dalton. Bailey can finish out the school year there.
I close my eyes. How am I here again? On the phone with Jake? How is Jake the one who is helping me? When we ended our relationship, Jake said I'd always felt absent to him. I didn't argue with him. I couldn't, because I was a little absent. It had felt like something was missing with Jake, the very thing I'd thought I had with Owen. But if Jake is correct about Owen, then Owen and I didn't have what I thought we did. Maybe we didn't have anything close to it at all. I appreciate the offer. And right now, it doesn't sound so bad.
But,
he says, from what you're telling me, we got here because Owen ran away, I say. I can't run away too,
Not until I get to the bottom of this.
Hannah, you really need to think of Bailey here.
I open the hotel room door and peek in. Bailey is sound asleep on her bed. She is curled up in the fetal position, her purple hair sticking out like a disco ball on the pillows. I close the door, step back into the hall. That's all I'm thinking of, Jake, I say.
Not yet, it's not, he says. Or you wouldn't be trying to find the one person that, in my opinion, you should be keeping her away from.
Jake, he's her father, I say.
Maybe someone should remind him, he says.
I don't say anything. I look out over the glass walls and into the atrium below. Work colleagues, complete with their laminated conference name tags, are lounging in the hotel bar. Couples are heading out of the restaurant, hand in hand. Two exhausted parents are carrying their sleeping children and enough Legoland paraphernalia to open a store. From this far away, they all look happy, though of course I don't really know. But for just a moment, I wish I could be any of them, as opposed to the person I am, hiding in a hotel hallway 8 floors up, trying to process that her marriage, her life, is a lie. I feel anger surging inside of me. Ever since my mother left, I pride myself on the details, seeing the smallest things about a person. And if someone asked me 3 days ago, I would have said I know everything there is to know about Owen, everything that matters anyway. But maybe I know nothing, because here I am, struggling to figure out the most basic details of all.
Sorry, Jake says. That was a little harsh.
That was a little harsh?
Look, I'm just saying that you've got a place here if you decide you want it, he says. Both of you do. No strings. But if you decide not to take me up on that, at least make another plan. Before you go ripping that girl's life apart, convince her you know what you're doing.
Who knows what they're doing in a situation like this, Jake? I say. Who finds themselves in a situation like this?
Apparently you do, he says.
That's helpful.
Come to New York, he says. That's as helpful as I know how to be.
8 months ago. I didn't agree to this, Bailey said. We were standing outside a flea market in Berkeley, and Owen and Bailey were in a rare standoff. He wanted to go in. The only place Bailey wanted to go was home.
You did agree, Owen said, when you agreed to come to San Francisco. So, how about sucking it up?
I agreed to get dim sum, she said.
And the dim sum was good, wasn't it? He said. I gave you my last pork bun. As a matter of fact, so did Hannah. That's 2 extra pork buns.
What's your point? She says.
How about being a good sport and heading inside with us for 30 minutes or so?
She turned on her heels and walked into the flea market, ahead of us, the requisite 10 feet ahead of us, so no one would guess we were all together. She was done negotiating with her father, and apparently she was done celebrating my birthday. Owen gave me an apologetic shrug.
Welcome to 40, he said.
Oh, I'm not 40, I said. I'm 21.
Oh, that's right, he smiled. Great. Then I have 19 more chances to get this right.
I took his hand, his fingers locking around mine. Why don't we just go home? I said. Brunch was so nice. If she's ready to go home...
She's fine.
Owen, I'm just saying, this isn't a big deal.
No, it isn't a big deal, he said. It isn't a big deal for her to suck it up and enjoy a lovely flea market. She'll be fine walking around for a half hour.
He leaned down to kiss me, and we started to head inside, to find Bailey. We were just through the front gate when a large man on his way out stopped walking and called out after Owen.
No way, he said.
He was wearing a baseball cap and a matching jersey,
stretched out over his stomach, and he was carrying a lampshade, a yellow velvet lampshade with the price tag still on it. He reached out to hug Owen, the lampshade awkwardly knocking Owen on the back.
"I can't believe it's you," he said. "How long has it been?"
Owen pulled away from him, careful to disentangle himself in a way that kept the lampshade safe.
20 years? 25? He said. "How does the prom king miss all the reunions?"
"I hate to tell you, pal, but I think you have the wrong guy," Owen said. "I've never been king of anything. Just ask my wife." Owen gestured to me. And the guy, the stranger, smiled in my direction.
"It's good to meet you," he said. "I'm Waylon."
"Hannah," I said. Then he turned back to Owen.
"Wait, so you're telling me that you didn't go to Roosevelt? Class of 1994?
"Nope, I went to Newton High in Massachusetts," Owen said.
"You got the year right, though." "Man, you are a dead ringer for this guy I went to school with. I mean, the hair is pretty different, and he was more jacked than you. No offense. I was more jacked, too, back then."
Owen shrugged. "We all were."
"A dead ringer, though."
He shook his head.
"It's probably a good thing you're not him, though. He was kind of a dick."
Owen laughed.
"Take it easy," he said.
"You too," Waylon said. Then he started to walk toward the parking lot. But then he turned back.
"Do you know anyone who went to Roosevelt High in Texas?" he said. "Like a cousin or something? You've got to at least be related."
Owen smiled gently.
"Sorry, buddy," he said. "Hate to disappoint you, but I'm not even close to the right guy."
"Sorry, we're open." Jake's words pound in my head. Owen Michaels doesn't exist. Owen isn't Owen. He's deceived me about the most central details of his life. He deceived his daughter about the most central details of hers. How is that possible? It feels entirely impossible, considering the man I thought I knew. I do know him. I still believe this, despite the evidence to the contrary. And this belief in him, in us, will either show me to be a steadfast partner or a complete fool. Hopefully, those don't turn out to be the same thing. After all, this is what I thought I knew. 28 months ago, a man walked into my workshop in New York City wearing a sports jacket and Converse sneakers. On the way to the theater that night, he took me to dinner at a small tapas restaurant on 10th Avenue, and he started to tell me the story of his life. It began in Newton, Massachusetts, and included 4 years at Newton High, followed by 4 years at Princeton University, a move to Seattle, Washington, with his college sweetheart, and then a move to Sausalito, California, with his daughter. There were 3 jobs and 2 degrees and 1 wife before me, who he'd lost in a car accident. It was a car accident he could barely talk about more than a decade later, his face cloudy and dark. Then there was his daughter, the highlight of his story, the highlight of his life, his headstrong, inimitable daughter. He moved with her to a small town in Northern California because she'd pointed to it on a map and said, "Let's try there." And that was something he could give her. This is what his daughter thought she knew. She'd spent the majority of her life in Sausalito, California, in a floating home with a father who never missed a soccer game or a school play. There were Sunday night dinners at restaurants of her choosing, and a weekly trip to the movies. There were lots of jaunts to San Francisco museums, plenty of neighborhood potlucks, and the annual barbecue. She didn't remember their life before Sausalito, except in vague snapshots. A birthday party with a great magician, a trip to the circus where she cried at the clown,
a wedding somewhere in Austin, Texas. Bailey filled in the blanks with what her father told her. Why wouldn't she? That's how you fill in the blanks, with stories and memories from the people who love you. If they lie to you, like he did, who are you then? Who is he? The person you thought you knew, your favorite person, starts to disappear, a mirage, unless you convince yourself the parts that matter are still true. The love was true. His love is true. Because if it isn't, the other option is that it was all a lie. And what are you supposed to do with that? What are you supposed to do with any of this? How do you put the pieces together so he doesn't disappear completely? So his daughter doesn't feel like she is going to disappear completely, too. Bailey wakes up shortly after midnight. She rubs her eyes. Then she looks over to find me sitting in the crappy hotel desk chair, watching her. "Did I fall asleep?" she says. "You did." "What time is it?" she says. "Late. You should go back to bed." She sits up. "It's kind of hard with you staring at me," she says. "Bailey, did you ever visit your father's childhood home in Boston?" I say. "Did he ever take you to see his house?" She looks at me confused. "Like where he grew up?" I nod. "No, he never took me to Boston. He barely went back there himself." "And you never met your grandparents?" I say. "You never spent any time with them?" "They died before I was born," she says. "You know that. What's going on?" Who is going to fill in this blank for her? This kind of hole? I don't know where to start. "Are you hungry?" I say. "You must be hungry. You barely touched your dinner. And I'm famished." "Why? You ate both our dinners all on your own." "Get dressed, okay?" I say. "Would you get dressed?" She looks at the fluorescent hotel radio clock. "It's midnight," she says. I put a sweater on and toss her sweatshirt to her. She looks down at it, splayed across her legs, her Converse sneakers peeking out beneath the hood. She pulls the sweatshirt over her head, pushing the hood all the way down until her purple hair is sticking out. "Can I at least get a beer?" she says. "Absolutely not. I have a fake ID that says otherwise," she says. "Please get dressed," I say. Magnolia Cafe is an Austin institution, famous for all-night eats, which might explain why it is still busy, music playing every booth taken at 12:45 a.m. We get two large coffees and an order of gingerbread pancakes. Bailey seems to love the sweet, spice-filled pancakes dripping in butter and coconut sugar. Bananas on the side. And watching her take them down, if nothing else, makes me feel like I'm doing something good for her. We sit by the door, a neon red, "Sorry, we're open" sign flashing above our heads. I blink against it and try to find the words to tell her what Jake told me. "It seems that your father hasn't always gone by the name Owen Michaels," I say. She looks up at me. "What are you talking about?" she says. I speak softly, but unapologetically, filling her in. I let her know that her father's name isn't the only thing he's changed. The details of his life, the story of his life, are something he has apparently altered as well. He didn't grow up in Massachusetts. He isn't a graduate of Princeton University. And he didn't move to Seattle at 22. At least he hasn't done those things in a way that we can prove. "Who told you that?" "A friend back in New York. He works with an investigator who focuses on this kind of thing. The investigator believes that your father changed his identity shortly before you moved to Sausalito. He's sure of it." She looks down at her plate, confused, like she's heard the words wrong.
all of it feeling impossible to compute.
"Why would he do that?" she says, not meeting my eyes.
"My guess is he was trying to keep you safe from something, Bailey."
"Like what? Like something he did?
'Cause my father would be the first to say that if you're running from something, it's usually yourself."
"We don't know that for sure."
"Right. All we know for sure is that he lied to me," she says. And I see it start to rise up in her, her anger. Her justifiable anger at being excluded from the most basic details of her life. Even if he was doing it for her own good. Even if he was doing it because he didn't have a choice. One way or another, she is going to have to decide whether that's forgivable. We both are.
"He also lied to me," I say. She looks up.
"I'm just saying, he lied to me too."
She tilts her head, like she is trying to figure out whether she believes that, whether she can take that at face value.
Why would she? Why would she believe anyone at this point? But it feels critical to try and assure her anyway, assure her that she can trust me, that I didn't deceive her too. It feels like everything hinges on her believing that.
She looks at me with such vulnerability, it's hard for me to speak. It's hard for me to even hold her gaze without breaking down. Which is when I understand in a flash what I've been doing wrong with her. What I've been doing wrong and how I've been trying to connect with her. I thought if I were nice enough, sweet enough, she'd understand she could count on me. But that's not how you learn you can count on someone. You learn it in the moments when everyone's too tired to be sweet. Too tired to try hard. You learn it by what they do for you then. And what I'm going to do for her now is what my grandfather did for me. I'll do whatever it takes for her to feel that she is safe.
"So it wasn't just him, right?" she says. "If he did this, I'm not who he said I am either then, right? My name and everything. At some point he changed it."
"Yes," I say. "If Jake's correct, then yes, you used to go by something else as well.
And all the details are different too, right?" She pauses. "Like my birthday?"
That stops me. The heartbreak in her voice when she asks that question.
"Like my birthday is not really my birthday?" she says.
"No. Probably not." She looks down. She looks away from me.
"That seems like something a person should know about themselves," she says.
I fight back tears, gripping the table, the small table in this happy Austin restaurant. Paintings on the wall, bright colors, all of it completely antithetical to how I feel. I will myself to stop, blinking the tears back. A 16-year-old girl who apparently has no one but me needs me not to cry. She needs me to be there for her. So I pull myself together, giving her the space to fall apart, letting her be the one to do that. She folds her hands on the table, tears filling her eyes, and I feel nearly leveled by it, watching her in that kind of pain.
"Bailey, I know this feels impossible," I say, "but you are you. Whatever details are around that, whatever your father didn't tell you, that doesn't change who you are, not at your core." "But how can I have no memory of being called something else, of where I lived? I should remember, shouldn't I?"
"You just said it yourself. You were a kid. You were just coming into consciousness when you became Bailey Michaels. None of this is a reflection on you at all."
"Just on him," she says. I think again about the guy at the Berkeley flea market, the guy who called Owen a prom king. Owen's calm reaction to him. He was completely unfazed. Could he have faked that so well? And what did it say about him if he did? You don't remember anyone ever calling your father anything else, do you? Before Sausalito?
Like a nickname? She says.
No, more like by another name completely.
I don't think so.
I don't know.
She pushes her coffee across the table.
I can't believe this is happening.
I know. She starts twirling her hair in her hands, the purple getting mixed up with her dark nail polish, her eyes blinking wildly as she tries to think.
I have no idea what anyone called him, she says. I never paid attention. Why would I?
She sits back, done guessing about her father, done guessing about her past, and completely exhausted from feeling like she has to. Who can blame her? Who wants to be sitting in a strange Austin restaurant trying to figure out who the most important person in your world was pretending to be, and how you missed it? Who he actually was.
You know what? Let's just go, I say.
It's late. Let's go back to the hotel and try to get some sleep.
I start to stand up, but Bailey stops me.
Wait, she says.
I sit back down.
Bobby said something to me a couple months ago, she says. He was applying to college and wanted to ask my father for an alumni recommendation for Princeton. But when he looked him up in the list of alums, he said he couldn't find an Owen Michaels anywhere. Not as a graduate in the engineering school, not as a student in the regular college either. I said obviously he looked it up in the wrong place, and then he got into University of Chicago and just dropped it. I never even remembered to ask Dad. But I just assumed it was Bobby not knowing how to work the alumni database or whatever.
She pauses.
Maybe I should have asked him.
Bailey, why would you? Why would you assume he was lying to you?
Do you think he was ever going to tell me? She says.
Did he plan to take me for a walk one day and let me in on who I really am?
Honestly, was he going to tell me that basically everything I knew about my life was a lie?
I look at her in the dim light. I think of my conversation with Owen, the conversation about taking a vacation to New Mexico. Was he actually thinking of letting me into some of this then? If I'd pushed a little harder, would he have?
I don't know, I say. I expect her to say how unfair that is. I expect her to get upset again, but she stays calm.
What's he so scared of? She says.
It stops me. Because that's it. That feels like the crux of all of this. Owen is running from something that he is terrified of. He has spent his life running from it. And more important, he has spent his entire life trying to keep Bailey from it.
I think when we figure that out, we'll know where he is now, I say.
Oh, well, easy enough, she says. Then she laughs, but the laughter turns fast, tears filling her eyes. But just as I think she is going to say that she wants to get out of here, that she wants to go back to the hotel, to go back to Sausalito, she seems to find her center. She seems to find something like resolve.
So what do we do now? She says.
We. What do we do now? We are in this together, it seems, which warms my heart, even if it's taken us to this all-night diner in South Austin, far from our home, even if it's taken us into territory we never wanted to be in, that I would give anything so that Bailey didn't have to be in. We are here together, and we both want to keep going. We both want to find Owen, whatever he has been hiding, wherever he is now.
Now, I say, we fix this.
Two can play at that game. I wait until the morning to call him. I wait until I feel calm and I'm sure I can do what I need to do. I gather up all of my notes and throw on a sundress. I close the door to the hotel room quietly, careful not to wake Bailey.
Then I head downstairs, through the bustling lobby, and go outside, where I can walk along the street, where I can control better what he hears in the background. It is still quiet out, the lake placid and peaceful, even with the morning rush, commuters on their way over the Congress Street Bridge, heading into their offices, their children's schools, on their way to start their blessedly normal days. I reach into my pocket and pull out the napkin from Fred's, Grady's cell phone number underlined twice. I turn on my cell phone, pressing *67 first before I tap in the number, hoping this will help block my call a little bit longer, if he is so inclined to unblock it, if he is so inclined to try and figure out where I am. "This is Grady," he says when he picks up. I brace myself to lie. This is, after all, what there is left to do. "It's Hannah," I say. "I heard from Owen." This instead of hello. "When?" Grady says. "Late last night, around 2 a.m. He said he couldn't talk in case someone was listening to the call, tracking him. He called from a payphone or something. It came up as a blocked number, and he was talking fast. He wanted to know if I was okay, if Bailey was okay, and he was adamant that he didn't have any part in what is going on at the shop. He said he'd had a feeling Abbott was up to something, but he didn't know the depth of it." I can hear Grady on the other end of the phone, rustling around. Maybe he is looking for a notepad, something on which to write down the clues he seems to think I am going to give him. "Tell me what he said exactly," he says. "He said it wasn't safe for him to stay on the phone, but that I should call you," I say. "That you'd tell me the truth." The rustling stops. The truth? About what? "I don't know, Grady. Owen made it sound like you'd know how to answer that." Grady pauses. "It's early in California," he says. "What are you doing up so early?" "Would you be able to go back to sleep if your husband called you at 2 a.m. and told you he was in trouble?" "I'm a pretty good sleeper, so," he says. "I need to know what's going on, Grady. What's really going on here," I say. "Why does a U.S. Marshal based in Austin, Texas, come all the way to San Francisco seeking out someone who isn't a suspect?" "And I need to know why you're lying to me about Owen calling you when he obviously did not. Why are there no records of Owen Michaels before he got to Sausalito?" I say. "Who told you that?" he said. "A friend." "A friend? You're getting some faulty information from your friend," he says. "I don't think so," I say. "Okay, well, did you remind your friend that one of the primary functions of the shop's new software is to alter your online history? That it helps you erase a trail you don't want to leave, correct? No online trail as to who you are. That includes online databases to universities, housing records." "I know how the software works. So why hasn't it occurred to you that if anyone expunged Owen's record, it might have been the one man who has the capability to do so?" "Owen." He is saying Owen made the trail to his past run cold. "Why would he do that?" I say. "Maybe he was testing out his software," he says. "I don't know. I'm just saying you're making up quite an elaborate story when there are a variety of explanations as to what your friend did or didn't find out about Owen's past." He is trying to throw me off balance. I won't let him. I won't let him try to control this narrative for his own agenda, which is feeling increasingly suspicious. "What did he do, Grady, before all of this, before the shop? Why did he change his identity? Why did he change his name?" "I don't know what you're talking about." "I think you do," I say. "I think that explains why you came all the way to San Francisco for an investigation you have no jurisdiction over." He laughs. "My jurisdiction puts me firmly in charge of this investigation," he says. "I think you should probably worry a little less about that and more about some other things."
"Like what?"
Like the fact your pal Special Agent Naomi Wu at the FBI is threatening to name Owen as an official person of interest. I pause. I haven't said her name. He knew her name. He seems to know everything.
We don't have a whole lot of time before her team shows up at your house with search warrants. I'm fighting hard to hold her off for the moment, but I can't guarantee you it will keep going this way.
I think of Bailey having to come home to see her room turned apart, her world turned apart.
Why, Grady?
Excuse me?
Why are you fighting so hard to stop that from happening?
That's my job, he says.
He says it assuredly, but I'm not convinced, because something has clicked in for me. Grady doesn't want any of this for Owen any more than I do. Grady wants to keep Owen away from that fate. Why is that? If Grady were just investigating Owen, if he were just trying to bring him in, if he was just trying to end this, he wouldn't care as much as he does. But something else is going on here. Something far more nefarious than Owen being implicated in simple fraud. And suddenly I feel terrified that that something is worse than anything I have imagined yet.
Protect her.
Owen left us a bag of money, I say.
What are you talking about? He says.
Really, he left it for Bailey. It's a lot of money. And if someone shows up with one of those search warrants you're threatening me with, I don't want them discovering it. I don't want it used against me, or as an excuse to take Bailey from me.
That's not how this works.
I'm still new to how this works, so in the meantime, I'm telling you about the money, I say. It's under my kitchen sink. I don't want anything to do with it.
He is quiet.
Well, I appreciate that. It's better that I take it than that they find it, he says. I can have someone in our San Francisco office come out and get it.
I look out past Lady Bird Lake at Austin's downtown, its gentle buildings, the trees letting through the morning light. Grady is probably in one of those buildings already, starting his day. Grady is closer than I suddenly want him to be.
Now's not a good time.
Why not?
Everything in my body tells me to tell him the truth. We are in Austin. But I'm still not sure whether he is a friend or a foe, or both. Maybe everyone is a little bit of both, Owen included. I need to get some work done before Bailey gets up, I say. And I've been thinking, maybe I should take Bailey somewhere else until this all calms down.
Like where?
I think of Jake's offer. I think of New York. I'm not sure, I say. But we don't have to be in Sausalito, do we? I mean, we don't have to stay there for any legal reason, correct?
Not officially, but it won't look good, he says.
Then Grady pauses. He pauses as if hearing something.
Wait, why did you just say there?
What?
You said we don't have to stay there. Talking about your house, talking about Sausalito. If you were home, you would have said here. We don't have to stay here.
I don't say anything.
Hannah, I'm sending one of my colleagues over to check on you, he says.
I'll put on some coffee, I say.
This isn't a joke, he says.
I don't think it is.
So then where are you? Grady says.
If Grady wants to trace my phone call, I know he can do it. For all I know, he is already trying to do it. I look out at Grady's hometown, wondering what it's been for my husband.
Where are you worried I'll be, Grady? I say.
Then, before he can answer, I hang up the phone.